to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio in real time via ZipWhip landline texting at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
We're going to talk to a local author this morning. I have been looking forward to this for a while. It is a book that's been out for a couple of months, and it's a one-of-a-kind book, deals with this area. Former freelance style reporter Jim Hall with us this morning. He is the author of The Last Lynching in Northern Virginia, Seeking Truth at Rattlesnake Mountain. Jim, it is good to have you here. Good morning.
Good morning, Ted. Thank you very much.
You and I were, over the years, covered a lot of stories together, and it's good to have you here.
Thank you. I was thinking about this last night. How far back do we go? I wonder about it.
I did the same thing, and I wonder, because I think I remember sitting with you at City Hall.
I agree.
And I think that was in the early to mid-80s.
Yes.
I think we did City Council together, and then seemed to cover. And then you did your last few years with the paper anyway. You did health for a while,
the health beat. 12 years to health and medicine. But I spent many a long, boring night at city council chambers.
Yes, sitting through those agendas and waiting. And you also, we sat through many a Gordon Shelton slideshow on something. So it's good to
see you again.
It's good to see you again. You've been retired for a few years. Was writing a book something that you always had in the back of your mind?
Yes, I learned about this story when I was a master's degree student at VCU. I wrote my thesis on how Virginia newspapers covered lynching. And don't ask me how I got that topic, but for some reason that interested me tremendously, and it was just fascinating to explore. While I was working on that, this incident was one that was in the literature. 1932, Fauquier County. I had chosen my study period 1880 to 1930. That's sort of a standard study period for lynching scholars. And so I decided I would go ahead and adopt it as well. This incident, 32, fell just outside the study period, so I was able to sort of set it aside.
Mm-hmm.
And worked on published the master's thesis. And then sort of slowly came back to this incident, making trips to Fauquier, driving the 40 miles to look at material in the Fauquier Library, to interview people who might be able to recall or help me learn more about this incident. Then when retirement came, that allowed me to spend a lot more time, both in the gathering of information, I went to libraries all over the Virginia, and in the actual sitting down and writing of it. When I finished, I queried publishers and was fortunate to find History Press, a traditional publisher out of Charleston, South Carolina, and they agreed to publish it. It came out in September, 2 months ago.
I was when I saw, because I think I saw something on Facebook over the summer that you had announced that this was coming out, and it made perfect sense for someone like you who'd been in this area, had been covering news, and Fauquier County is on the fringes of what we all cover, but we still cover it. And I thought, boy, this makes perfect sense for you. You know the landscape.
And I felt like I also had the skills that were needed to accomplish the task. I was familiar with interviewing, with setting up interviews, with talking to folks, and to going into courthouses and libraries and working my way through the stacks to find what was of use.
And you find that in the book. It's a fast read. I was telling you, I started it one night, and we'll get into the story as we go along this morning. But in the first chapter, it's riveting the way you tell the story of the initial happenings. I hated to put it down, but it's a very fast read, but it's very scholarly. You have it. There are all kinds of notes, and there's the reporter. There's the reporter in you, and it's scholarly, but it's also well researched.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Somebody told me the other day that they thought I was a great storyteller, and that to me is the highest compliment that I could be paid. I knew I had to tell the details, but I also wanted to introduce readers to the characters, to Fauquier County at the time. And I wanted to weave all of that into a enjoyable whole. And that was the challenge. That it was 33,000 words, 10, 20 times longer than the standard newspaper article.
Yeah.
So that was a challenge for me. How do I structure this to make it a good read?
Yeah, it goes in, and you do. It goes in and out of the story, but you also talk about the history and Governor Byrd, and nationally you look at things, and in the state, and you go back and forth. And the other thing, and not to, to downplay, a lot of people now, it's gotten very easy to self-publish. This is much deeper than a self-published book.
The whole self-publishing industry to me is fascinating. I think I was... My prejudice, coming from a different tradition, is that you go with a traditional publisher if you can. That's the way, that's the highest rung on the ladder. I'm beginning to wonder if that's true anymore, that if I've met so many authors who self-publish, that I'm beginning to wonder if maybe self-publishing is not what I thought it was. But I went the traditional route. I was very flattered that History Press, they have a line of books they call their True Crime series. I learned that before querying them and pitched the idea to them that this was a true crime story, and that worked. Within 24 hours, I had an offer to that they wished to publish it. So I was lucky.
Yeah. So had you already written it by the time you went to them?
Yes.
Okay.
I sat down and wrote it, and I was in this sort of middle ground, this no man's land. I had 33,000 words. That is, a standard news magazine article would be maybe 10,000 words, and a book would be maybe 60,000 words.
Yeah.
60 to 90,000 words. So at 33,000 words, I was nobody's friend, in a sense. So I needed to figure that out, and History Press was perfect for me. They said, we're soft cover, we're full of pictures, and we're at about the 30 to 40,000 word range for our books. And I thought, well, you know something? I think we got a marriage here.
How is this different than what you did as a reporter of always working with an editor who would work? Probably a lot of it was very similar.
Very similar. It was much more intense, whereas you would talk to two or three people, maybe four or five, for a standard story, depending on its length and complexity. This was dozens and dozens of people that I had to talk to. I was on this permanent quest to find more information, to fill in these blanks, to put more pieces into the puzzle. So that made it very difficult. It was difficult, but it was also very different than my standard operating procedure. I had the time, and I had the interest. The story never bored me, and I was able to accomplish it.
It's The Last Lynching in Northern Virginia, Seeking the Truth at Rattlesnake Mountain. It's based in Fauquier. Former Freelance Star reporter Jim Hall is the author. He lives in downtown Fredericksburg. He's with us this morning. More on Town Talk this morning. We'll get into the story and talk about lynchings this morning as we go along. On News Talk 1230 WFVA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Jim Hall here this morning. We're talking about The Last Lynching in Northern Virginia, Seeking Truth at Rattlesnake Mountain. It is a book that came out in September. He's the author of... I found it interesting in the book as you got into lynchings, because then my first question as I got into the book was, were there any around here? And it appears you talk about Culpeper, Fauquier, and Prince William.
Right.
But in Stafford, Spotsylvania, city, that kind of area, that never came up in anything that you mentioned.
To my knowledge, Stafford and Spotsylvania did not have a lynching during this brutal period in American history. And Fredericksburg had a very interesting one. There was an accused criminal in the Fredericksburg jail, and a mob developed and sought to remove him from the jail and lynch him, which was a very standard practice at that time, more standard than, is almost shockingly standard. And the sheriff's name was Chichester. And those of who have lived in the Fredericksburg area for a long time will recognize that name. I have no idea if he was related to the current Chichesters, those who have served in state government. But he stood in the jailhouse door and refused to surrender his prisoner, which was a very unusual move for a local sheriff. Most local sheriffs decided that they weren't going to risk their lives for anybody. And so when a mob arrived at the door to take the prisoner and murder him, they surrendered him without a fight. This Sheriff Chichester decided otherwise, and he resisted the city's only attempted lynching.
So lynchings, in a way, these were just mobs.
Yes, this was mob rule. This was chaos, anarchy, whatever you want to call it. There was a very dark period in American history from about 1880 to 1930, where lynchings occurred in every state in the Union. But 80% of them, at least 80% of them, occurred in what we know as the Old South, the Confederacy. The numbers vary. Depends on which states you examine, which historian you read, which time period you look at. But there seems to be a consensus that from about 1880 to about 1930, we had about 3,000 lynchings in the South, in the 10 southern states. What that means is that for a 50-year period in our history, a black person was killed by a mob of angry whites once a week.
Wow.
Yes. Once a week, a black person was killed by an angry mob in the South.
And we don't hear, I mean, that we just don't hear about this.
No. I see it as a part of a continuum, sort of a difficult aspect of American life, and that is the relationships between white and black. It began with what some call America's original sin, slavery. And for 250 years, the slavery was practiced most frequently in the Deep South. But then with liberation, the Civil War and with liberation, that did not bring us peace. We find this lynch period then began, and then later systematized attempts by governments in the South to disenfranchise blacks. We see the Jim Crow period, we see the civil rights struggle, and we even see today is sort of our current very difficult political climate. Mm-hmm. I see lynching as a part of that continuum.
In lynching cases, was it always a person was hung?
No, there were many examples of other types of mob murder. There is a famous case from 1903 when a black man was aboard a train going from North Carolina to West Virginia. And the train stopped in Luray. He did not know that at that time in Luray, the citizens of Luray did not allow black people in Luray. He was chased by a mob. He ran towards the Shenandoah River, trying to escape the mob, ran across a dam, and then fell off the dam and drowned in the Shenandoah River. So we find many examples of other kinds of murder, but hanging seemed to be the most frequent.
Jim Hall here, the author of The Last Lynching in Northern Virginia. It's a book that came out in September. It is History Press who published it, and we'll get into how you can get a hold of it as we go along this morning. This morning too, I guess, Jim, what's really concerning as you read the book and as we talk this morning, and yeah, like you mentioned, the way society is today, unfortunately, you can see when we see things in the news with mobs now, and you worry, and you just think, how far away are we from this, and could it come back?
I don't think it could come back. I think there was a breakdown in established order at that time.
Okay.
I don't think there's any sheriff alive today in even the smallest southern town that would allow a mob to take his prisoner from the jail. But that happened often during this period. I think sheriffs would mobilize, call for help, called in the state police. It wouldn't happen. It just wouldn't happen. I pray to God that what we might see and probably have seen are underground, what I call underground lynchings, where small bands of private citizens do it and then don't talk about it. It's not a public act so much.
Yeah.
We saw the change in this case as well.
Was there ever any type? Did the General Assembly ever get involved, or was there anybody that wanted to come up with anti-lynching legislation, so to speak?
Yes, Virginia was the first, and I believe the only state to pass anti-lynching legislation in 1927. That made it a state crime, as well as a local crime. It gave the state authority to step in. Of course, what was happening is that the lynching would occur, but the local authorities, the sheriff, the Commonwealth's attorney, the judges, they were friends and sometimes participants in the mob. And so there would be no action taken. There was almost never any action taken against lynchers. And so Virginia thought that if we made it a state crime, specifically a state crime, then the state could intervene without being invited. And that's what happened, though the state rarely used that power. I'm not sure if I can think of any instance when it did. It was on the books.
Were there parts of Virginia where this was a bigger problem than others, or did it just pop up here and there?
It's easy when you look at the map of Virginia and you plot the incidents that occurred. We had about 77 incidents in Virginia in this 1880 to 1930. They were all over the state. It's easy. The top two or three are in Southwest Virginia. But then if you look at the list of the places where the most lynchings occur, they're all over the place. They're in Fauquier, they're in Loudoun, they're in the Charlottesville area, they're in the Tidewater area, and in the Southwest. I don't think it's fair to blame or to say that it was a phenomenon of the Southwest Virginia. The mountain people, the rural, ignorant mountain people were the only ones that did this. That's not true. It was everywhere. Alexandria had two very bad incidents where prisoners were taken from the jail and lynched on the city streets.
Your book, if someone's interested in getting it, I'm sure there are a number of ways they can.
There are online retailers. Your favorite online retailer certainly has it. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. History Press operates its own website and marketplace. Downtown in Fredericksburg, it's available at the Agora Coffee Shop. It is also available at Central Park at the Barnes & Noble and at Books A Million.
So it's around. I'm guessing that on the cover is that the Fauquier County Courthouse?
Yes,
at the top?
It is. Okay. Yes, it is. The remains of the lynched person, his name was Shedrick Thompson, were briefly stored under the steps of the courthouse in this incident.
How'd you come up with the name?
The title. That is a. I fought the title, to be honest with you. History Press. I had it. My working title was Death on Rattlesnake Mountain. I thought that was catchy. And History Press. This is one thing that happens with a traditional publisher. With self-publishing, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But in this case, you can't. History Press said, we want the title changed. And we Rattlesnake Mountain, apparently there are three Rattlesnake Mountains in the United States. So the title Death on Rattlesnake Mountain can't carry the burden of work that a title needs to carry.
Yeah.
Because it isn't unique. The Rattlesnake isn't unique. And they said they have learned that if the featured locality is in the title, the book sells better.
Okay.
So they
Northern Virginia.
They wanted to call it Northern Virginia. I'm a lifelong Virginia resident, and it struck me that this was something that was dreamed up by somebody in South Carolina. I'm not sure I would have called the Fauquier Northern Virginia.
Well, that's what I did wonder, because I thought, you could make a case at Fauquier. I don't consider it.
There you go.
You consider more Prince. I mean, some people don't even consider Stafford Northern Virginia.
Exactly.
So it is exactly. The last lynching in Northern Virginia is the book. Jim Hall is the author, Seeking Truth at Rattlesnake Mountain. There's a female picture at the bottom. Is that Mamie Baxley?
That is Mamie Baxley. She was one of the two victims of the initial crime, which was an assault. And then the residents, both the sheriff in an organized way, and residents in a disorganized or unauthorized way, went out seeking the person who had assaulted her.
And we will get into that story when we come back. We'll hear about Henry and Mamie Baxley and Shedrick Thompson and others as we go along. The last lynching in Northern Virginia. Jim Hall, the author, is with us this morning. More in Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 8:31.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
Former freelance star reporter Jim Hall with us this morning. He is the author of The Last Lynching in Northern Virginia. And we get to the story now. Jim, it occurred 1932 in Fauquier County.
Yes, it did, Ted. It occurred in July of 1932. It was unusually, I'm very curious about what effect, if any, the weather had on the incident. But it was the nation, Virginia and Fauquier, were in the midst of a terrible heat wave. And this, of course, 1932, pre-air conditioning, and in fact, pre-electricity in the rural sections of the state, especially in rural Fauquier, where this took place. The middle of the night, a farmhand entered the home of his employer. His name was Shedrick Thompson. He had been in the employ of the Baxley family. He entered the home of Henry and Mamie Baxley. Their two-year-old son was asleep in an adjoining bedroom and never woke up during the attack. But the great mystery of this story is why he did what he did. But it seems without dispute that he entered the home from the rear in the middle of the night through the kitchen, picked up a piece of stove wood, mounted the stairs to the bedroom upstairs, and attacked the farm family, the Baxleys. They were in their early 30s. He was 39 at the time. Mr. Baxley, Henry Baxley, suffered serious, what I call defensive injuries, where he threw his hands up to protect his head and suffered a broken forearm. And then I talked to a man who remembers seeing him after the attack, and he said his face was swollen and bruised. Thompson then grabbed Mrs. Baxley in her nightclothes and barefoot, marched her down the steps of the house, out the front door, down the lane outside, the dirt lane, across the tar road, and across a farm field across the street. He took her a distance of several hundred yards. There he attacked her, assaulted her, beat her, stole her wedding rings, and also raped her, left her unconscious there in the farm field, and fled west into the mountains of northern Fauquier. The closest mountain there at that spot was Buck Mountain. She woke that morning. She woke soon after, it was daylight, crawled to a nearby tenant house. The couple that lived in the house came and helped her. The man went trying to get her family, and the woman tended to her bleeding wounds. The man found her family, and they took both her and her husband to Fauquier Hospital in Warrenton. He was treated and released for his injuries. She was hospitalized for 10 days. Then that began what was described as the largest manhunt in Fauquier history. Hundreds of people came from all over the region and all over all the parts of Fauquier to comb the mountains, Pigeon Perch, Rattlesnake, Buck Mountain, Africa Mountain, all of them, the string of mountains there in the northern Fauquier. In a sense, they are the foothills to the Blue Ridge, which are about 20 miles to the west. The search went on for days and days. Sheriff Wolf, Stanley Wolf, organized many posses that methodically marched through the woods. Also, self-assigned volunteer posses of smaller groups of 3 to 6 people took to the mountains on horseback and on foot, and searching for Thompson. What the public knew at the time is that he was not found. He was Sheriff Wolf chased down many a lead, some as far away as Culpeper, from reports that he had been sighted in those localities, but all proved untrue. He was not found, is what it amounts to. And the Fauquier went back to its normal life. These were farm families, farm workers, farm owners, and they had farms to tend to. Yeah. So they were not able to continue the search after a while. And so then we entered a long, what I call a kind of a quiet period, when what was the top news story in every newspaper for throughout the region, and there were quite a few more newspapers than there are today, but as well as in the Washington papers, I found accounts of the incident in a Chicago newspaper, in a Boston newspaper. So it was big news, but that news disappeared after a while, and life in Fauquier returned to normal. And then that normalcy lasted about 2 months. And then in September of that year, 1932, a farmer, a tenant farmer, was trying to figure out why his cattle were getting loose. And he was at the foot of Rattlesnake Mountain. He was, and he started walking the fence line around the property to figure out why. He figured there must have been a breach somewhere. Mm-hmm. And there he discovered, deep in the woods at the foot of Rattlesnake Mountain, was a black man hanging from a tree. He, of course, immediately understood who that was, even though the body was badly decomposed. He notified the closest sheriff's department, which was Warren County. They notified Warrenton in central Fauquier. Sheriff Wolf and his people immediately left for Rattlesnake, which was about 20 miles away from Warrenton. The word got out very quickly, though. The man made his discovery about 5 p.m., and the word got out very quickly in that immediate area that Thompson had been found. And a crowd developed on the mountain, 100, by one estimate, 150 people. And they set fire to his body. and destroyed all but the shoes and the skull. And then they removed the teeth from the skull as souvenirs. And what was left of Thompson was only that, the skull and the shoes, and the sheriff then took that back to Warrenton, where it was displayed by the coroner, Dr. George Davis, in his office for some period of time. What I did not know when I was working on the book is whatever happened to Thompson's skull. I found the Thompson family cemetery at Mount Morris in Hume, and Thompson is not among them. Shedrick Thompson is not among his family in the cemetery, and I surmised that there was not enough to bury, not enough left of him to bury.
Yeah.
But what I've learned since then, it was a phenomenon that I always experienced at the Freelance Star, in that once a story is published, those who were involved in that story, and you, though you may not have talked to them as a reporter, frequently will contact you to add to the story. Well, you didn't say this. Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That happened in this case as well. Some of the members of the Thompson family have contacted us. Myself and a person, Tom Davenport, that I've been working on, who's working on a film about this incident. We learned from a member of the Thompson family that Thompson's skull was delivered to his mother and placed on the family porch. And it disturbed Mrs. Thompson, as you could imagine, Fanny Thompson. And the quote was from the distant relation, was that she lived with that for the rest of her life. His death was immediately ruled a suicide by both the coroner that night on the mountain and then 1 week later by the grand jury that met, Fauquier Circuit Court grand jury. They decided that he had committed suicide. He had climbed in the tree, the apple tree on Rattlesnake Mountain, attached a rope to the tree and to his neck and jumped out. That made no sense to anybody. It was, in my opinion, a cover-up. It was an attempt, a sort of awkward attempt by Fauquier authorities to get this over with, get it behind us, and no one shall be blamed for this, and we will not suffer the stain of another lynching in our community. By that time, Virginia had gone about 4 years without any.
Okay.
And that did not sit very well with some of the residents of Fauquier, who knew better, especially those who lived in the area of the incident of the death in near Rattlesnake Mountain in northern Fauquier. It also did not sit very well with several national civil rights organizations, and they listed Thompson as a lynch victim. Every year, organizations such as the NAACP or Tuskegee Institute in Alabama would compile lynch lists, and they hoped that these lists of shame would encourage the localities to put a stop to this, for authorities to step forward and do their job and don't allow this to occur. And it seemed to work, that the number diminished greatly over the years. That was one factor that helped bring it to an end. But the NAACP and Tuskegee put Thompson on their list as a lynch victim, despite the coroner's decision and despite the grand jury report. Well, that infuriated former Governor Harry Byrd. Former Governor Harry Byrd was the architect of the anti-lynching legislation in the state, was a candidate for national office at the time. He was his name, he received votes on the first three ballots in the 1932 Democratic Convention in Chicago. The nomination was eventually taken by Franklin Roosevelt in the election. But Byrd was a very eager politician, eager to expand his national renown. And he was a neighbor of the Baxleys. He was a friend of the Baxleys. He had hunted quail on the Baxley farm. Henry Baxley was chairman of the Fauquier Democratic Party. He was an ally of Byrd, and Burr didn't want this on the record. He didn't want this on the state's record. It didn't want to have it on his own personal record. And he intervened and encouraged, demanded that the NAACP and Tuskegee remove Thompson's name from their lynch list because it was a suicide. He provided no evidence whatsoever to either of those organizations. And the NAACP, Walter White, the chairman, commented that these men who, and Byrd got his allies to write similar letters, these men who want Thompson's name removed are very insistent, but they provide no evidence. But Byrd exerted such pressure from his friends that Walter White did remove Thompson's name from the NAACP's annual lynch list, and he moved it, it created a new category, and moved the name Thompson to what he called a hairline case, kind of an undecided case. And that was exactly the solution that Byrd sought. He then was able to say that lynching stopped in Virginia with passage of the 1927 anti-lynching legislation, that he was a progressive Southern leader and did not represent a state where this sort of mob rule occurred.
Jim, with Jim Hall here, the last lynching in Northern Virginia is his book. We need to take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap this up and encourage you to get all the details on the last lynching in Northern Virginia, the book, and we'll tell you where you can get that. When we come back, we'll wrap this up on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFEA.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFEA. Got an opinion about today's show? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Now, here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
Jim Hall here, the author of The Last Lynching in Northern Virginia. It's the story of that centers around Henry and Mamie Baxley and Shedrick Thompson. We're not going to give away all of this because you want people to read the book. As you've though gone and interviewed people, have people come forward to back up some of what you thought?
Yes, actually my thinking changed. I think as a reporter, I went in. My training is to hear both sides, to hear all sides, and so I wanted to give weight to what was two official verdicts.
Yeah.
One from the coroner and one from the grand jury. Yet when I started talking to residents of Fauquier, black and white, and I think if you look in the acknowledgement section of the book, I thank 17 Fauquier residents. Others helped me as well, but they were very crucial, including Henry Baxley Jr., who was an infant in the home during the attack. He is now in his 80s and retired and living in Fauquier. He's a wonderful man, and he was very, very helpful to me during the process. Mm-hmm. So I talked to lots of people in Fauquier who were very helpful, and they to them, there is no controversy. There is no doubt. It's not a suicide, and anybody who says it's a suicide is being foolish.
Yeah.
It was a lynching. They all know that. I've met three who were alive at the time, but there were also many whose parents were alive and a part of it. And if you don't think this wasn't a dinner table conversation in 1932 in Fauquier County, you're nuts, because it was. And these stories were implanted deeply in people's experiences, and they were upset about it. They have never really understood why it went down as it did, and they were happy to talk about it.
How has Fauquier County reacted to this book?
There are two points of view, it seemed. I've been well received. The book has been well received in many quarters of Fauquier. But there is also, I don't know how to describe it, perhaps older Fauquier, more established Fauquier, the white power structure, if you want to call it that, They have been resistant. History Press sent a representative, a sales representative, on Main Street in Warrenton, going from door to door on the shops. There are no bookstores in Fauquier. That would be a natural place to... I believe there is one outside of town that is closing at the end of the year. But right there, there's no real Barnes & Noble, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that would be the logical place to put the book on sale in Fauquier, but there is none. So he went from door to door on Main Street, going to different kinds of gift shops and pharmacies, places that might carry a book and do carry books, without any success. He was not able to place the book anywhere in Warrenton, and the explanation was because of its sensitive nature.
Huh.
I didn't know history had to be sensitive. I thought history was just the telling of the story.
Yeah, well, I'm sure as a reporter and as somebody who's pursued this, it came as a surprise.
Yeah, very much so.
Interesting, no pictures of Shedrick Thompson in the book.
I tried my best, believe me. I knew how vital that would be to the reader to see what this man looked like, and I never found one.
Well, there may be one out there.
Yes.
There may be one out there. Looking in the book, Mammy Baxley lived to be what 100?
Almost 100 years old, right.
Did he ever say anything to her about why he did it?
If he did, she didn't say.
Okay.
The motive for the attack is the single most perplexing part of the story. I have really no idea why he did what he did. I have theories, and you'll find in the book there are at least four theories. The things I heard from people over time, but I have no real certainty about which one, why he did what he did.
And you said you were working with someone who's making this into a TV special or something?
Tom Davenport, award-winning filmmaker in Fauquier County, has long been interested in this story. And when he heard that I was working on it, he called me and said, you want to have a cup of coffee and talk about the possibility of maybe collaborating? And I jumped at it. He has lived there all his life and arranged interviews that I would have never been able to get. And so he filmed over my shoulder during many of the interviews. He has is compiling a lot of film about this incident, and he believes that he will finish a 1-hour documentary early next year, and then he will go about the task of placing it with television, TBS. I'm not sure where it will go from there.
And you mentioned that you can get it online in bookstores around the Fredericksburg area.
That's correct. Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Agora Coffee Shop, and of course the online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
The Last Lynching in Northern Virginia, Seeking Truth at Rattlesnake Mountain. It's based in Fauquier. Jim Hall, great to catch up with you. And as you find out more, come on back and let's do this again.
Thank you, Ted. It's been a pleasure.
That is it for Town Talk. Thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.